with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more. This is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
A third of the U.S. population suffers from frequent heartburn or a condition known as GERD. This week, we'll talk to a gastroenterologist from Harvard Medical School who says if you suffer from acid reflux, 5 diet and lifestyle changes may help. Then, while testicular cancer is relatively rare, it is the most common cancer in American males ages 15 to 35. We'll talk with a Mayo Clinic urologist to learn about the diagnosis and treatment of testicular cancer. And activities like walking are often recommended to reduce high blood pressure, but we'll talk to a researcher who has found an activity even more effective than walking. That's all straight ahead on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Roughly 1 in 3 Americans suffers from an annoying and potentially dangerous condition called GERD, gastroesophageal reflux. Patients often take medicines for this, but now a study is out saying that medicine may not be necessary for some patients who follow 5 diet and lifestyle guidelines. Joining us now to describe this is Dr. Andrew Chan, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and vice chair of gastroenterology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Doctor, please briefly describe gastroesophageal reflux, or GERD.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, gastroesophageal reflux, or GERD, is an incredibly common condition affecting about a third of the U.S. population. The main symptom of GERD is heartburn. And essentially what GERD is reflux or regurgitation of stomach acid from the stomach into the esophagus or the food pipe. So this can lead to a lot of discomfort and pain, but in its worst case can cause some actual erosions or damage to lower esophagus. And over time, if the damage is chronic enough, it can lead to some changes to the lining of the esophagus that could predispose people to esophageal cancer.
And isn't there an important muscle here that's at play?
Yes. So the stomach and the esophagus are connected by what we call the esophageal sphincter. So it's like a little valve that connects the food pipe to the stomach. And in people with GERD or reflux, that sphincter or muscle is weaker or doesn't function properly. So after you eat, sometimes the acid in your stomach washes back into your esophagus to cause the symptoms.
And what are the 5 factors or guidelines that your study found may substantially reduce symptoms and perhaps make medicine unnecessary?
The 5 factors include maintaining a normal body weight, not smoking, and being reasonably physically active for about 30 minutes a day, restricting your intake of coffee, tea, or soda to about 2 cups a day, and also trying to eat what we call a prudent diet, trying to eat a healthier choice of foods.
How does smoking in particular affect our gastrointestinal system and GERD?
It's a great question. I don't know that we know the complete story behind that. I think we do think that the effect of cigarette smoke or smoking might be causing weakness of that sphincter or that muscle between the esophagus and the stomach. In addition, I think there are some other mechanisms that smoking might have, which include changing the way our gastrointestinal tract works, or the motility of our gastrointestinal tract. So it's not entirely known, but it is pretty clear that people who smoke do have more reflux.
And if we don't look after ourselves, such as carrying too much weight or drinking too much of those beverages you mentioned, can this actually promote reflux or make the effects of it worse?
Yeah, I think that that's a reasonable conclusion to draw from the data. I think it's pretty clear that people who really try to observe these factors report minimal GERD-like symptoms. So our data also show that people who tend to be on the other side of the spectrum, in other words, they tend to be overweight or smoke and are physically inactive, those folks do have more symptoms. So I think it definitely is a situation where the better you can do on each of these factors, the less likely you're going to have reflux into your esophagus.
We're visiting with Dr. Andrew Chan, Vice Chair of Gastroenterology at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's the senior author of a recent study on reducing symptoms of a reflux commonly called GERD. Doctor, you've been hinting here that this is one of the first studies on physical activity's effect on GERD. How dramatic was the effect of enhanced physical activity?
Yeah, so we found that people who were the most physically active in our study had about a 30% reduction in risk of having two or more reflux symptoms a week. So it's a pretty substantial risk reduction. And I think taken into context with respect to other things that we know physical activity is important for, it does provide a pretty compelling rationale for people to try to stay as active as possible.
And why is it that exercise seems to have such a benefit?
Well, we do know that exercise does help people maintain a healthy body weight. But even independent of that, we think that there are really positive effects of being physically active. It's probable that physical activity promotes clearance of stomach acid. So the more active you are, your body may be more likely to be able to clear acid from the stomach into the intestines. So there's less of it to sort of backflow into the food pipe. In addition, I think being physically active probably also enhances normal gastrointestinal motility. So that's really how your sort of intestines and your GI tract move nutrients through the body. And I think being physically active tends to promote kind of a healthier motility, such that nutrients move more smoothly through the body and are cleared more quickly. And again, preventing backflow of stomach contents into the esophagus.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about protecting ourselves from GERD and how to know when it's time to call the doctor. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Andrew Chan, Vice Chair of Gastroenterology at Massachusetts General Hospital, regarding a recent study on reducing symptoms from GERD, an acid reflux, without medication. Doctor, we were talking before that GERD can be very serious. Over time, what can the stomach acid do to our esophagus? Can there be even scar tissue?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the most feared consequences of GERD. So the acid can definitely, in some people, cause symptoms of discomfort and pain, but it also can cause injury to the lower esophagus. So it actually can damage the tissue lining. And if that damage is sustained over a long period of time, the tissue can actually itself develop changes like scarring. And that scarring can lead to narrowing of the esophagus and the development of what we call strictures, so that the caliber of the esophagus or their food pipe becomes more narrow, which makes it more prone for people to develop blockages, where when they eat, for example, a piece of steak, that might get stuck in their food pipe. In addition, I think one of the real concerns is that with long-term damage from acid, the lining of the esophagus can develop precancerous changes, and those precancerous changes, you know, over time can lead to development of esophageal cancer, which is unfortunately a type of cancer for which we have not great solutions in terms of treatment. So we're really quite concerned about GERD as a public health problem and want to make sure that we really make people aware of trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle so they can avoid this complication.
We've often heard about ulcers in the stomach, but is there such a thing as an esophageal ulcer?
Yes. Over time, there can be enough damage of acid on the lower esophagus that it can cause development of ulcers in the esophagus. So just like you can develop ulcers in the stomach from too much acid, you can also develop ulcers in the esophagus from too much acid as well. So definitely another severe complication.
You've referenced one of the guidelines recommended in your study as a prudent diet. Let's talk about some of the things we should avoid. Fatty foods, do they promote or cause GERD?
Yes, we definitely have a clear sense that the intake of fatty foods, especially fried oily foods and processed foods, tends to promote GERD. We also think that there's probably a role for caffeine, so that may be why taking in too much coffee, tea, or soda may contribute to GERD. So overall, it does appear that things that we sort of associate with healthy eating are probably things that also will help minimize the amount of GERD that we experience.
I've heard anecdotal information that chocolate and red wine are also associated with the heartburn from GERD. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's also been something that's been discussed as well. And there is clear data that alcohol will promote reflux. And that is something that we also evaluated in our study. So we also did observe that people who consume high levels of alcohol also tend to have more GERD. But it's a little bit less clear how we want to adapt that into a sort of anti-reflux lifestyle, because people don't tend to drink alcohol continuously or regularly throughout the day. So it is important to kind of think about what it is that we can do in the course of a normal day. And that's the dietary components that we focused on the most. But there's certainly information out there that suggests that taking alcohol, particularly large amounts of alcohol, at any given time can also enhance GERD.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the time factor, because I was wondering if eating late at night promotes GERD or makes it worse?
Yeah, there is certainly a component of when you eat as much as how you eat or how much you eat. And we do recommend routinely to patients that they try to divide up their meals more evenly throughout the day so that they tend to have more frequent small meals interspersed through the day as opposed to one really large, heavy dinner. And in addition, we do really recommend quite routinely to our patients that after they eat, they try to stay upright for at least a couple hours. So, you know, sitting up straight, or if not standing up, or even better yet, going out for a walk after they eat, and trying to avoid taking any food or beverages for 2 hours before they go to sleep. Because once you lie flat, that also creates biomechanically some issues where it becomes easier for material from your stomach to reflux back into your esophagus. So we do generally recommend being pretty vigilant about making sure you don't have anything to eat right before you go to bed. And if possible, making sure your last meal of the day is not your largest meal of the day.
Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Chan, Vice Chair of Gastroenterology at Massachusetts General Hospital. Doctor, did your study discover whether patients using common heartburn treatments also got benefits from the 5 recommended guidelines?
They did. We did really also want to address the question, what does lifestyle have to add to medications? Because the medications that we commonly use to treat GERD, medicines known as proton pump inhibitors, such as omeprazole or commonly known as Prilosec, or other medications known as histamine blockers or H2 blockers, we do know those are very commonly used across the population. And as a result, we really wanted to know, for people who are already on those medications, does observing this healthy lifestyle also have a benefit? And we did find that it was helpful. So even if you are on these medications, it's worth your time to really think about how you can adjust your diet or your lifestyle to try to alleviate your symptoms. And in many cases, we expect that individuals might be able to wean themselves off these medications if they're successful in being able to observe these lifestyle modifications. So I think it's pretty clear that lifestyle and diet represent a really viable option for many people. And it can be a complement to what people might be doing medically.
And is there any chance that the lifestyle and diet choices your study recommends might at least be enough to reduce the dosages of the medicines for some of the patients with GERD?
Yeah, it's a reasonable expectation. We didn't specifically look to see whether lifestyle or diet could allow people who were on higher doses of the medicine to reduce their dosage. But we could expect that to be the case, because there's no reason to believe that there isn't a dose effect. In other words, the more you observe these factors, probably the less you'll need to take medication. So I do think there's probably a rationale to think about using these lifestyle modifications to help people reduce their dosage and ultimately, you know, wean themselves off the medications altogether.
But there are still some serious cases, are there not, doctor? What kinds of surgery could be needed for this condition?
There is, you know, a group of patients for whom medications and, unfortunately, lifestyle and diet are not enough. And in those cases, they might be referred for specific anti-reflux procedures that can be done to correct the fact that their lower esophageal sphincter or that valve is weak. Some of these are done endoscopically, meaning it's done through a special scope or camera that is passed into the mouth and is brought down into that area where the valve is to help strengthen it. And in other cases, it can be done with surgery where there is basically a procedure known as a Nissen-Flendo-plication where we take some of the muscles down in the diaphragm and wrap that around the lower esophagus to help tighten it up as well. So there are surgical or endoscopic options for people who are failing medications or diet and lifestyle.
As we mentioned, 1 in 3 Americans could be affected with this. And there are a variety of signs and symptoms. Can you run down those signs and symptoms for us?
Sure. You know, heartburn, again, is the most common symptom of GERD. And so most people will experience that sort of burning sensation in their lower chest. And that often is a symptom that kind of migrates up into their chest and even as high up as into their throat. It can also result in other types of symptoms that are more based in the larynx or the throat. So people can develop throat symptoms like a chronic cough or a chronic need to clear their throat. They can also develop a hoarse voice, and also they can develop some actual discomfort or a distaste in their mouth. So they may actually feel the reflux of gastric contents and acid into the back of their mouth, which can lead to a very unpleasant sensation. Some folks with GERD also experience really bad breath or halitosis. And they can also, again, with enough symptoms over time, they can develop complications where they develop a narrowing of their esophagus or a stricture. And that can result in difficulty with eating, such that they sometimes will have food impactions or food can get blocked in their esophagus and not pass into their stomach. If the symptoms become severe enough, it can really lead to difficulty with appetite. So people may find that they don't eat as well. And, you know, if there are enough changes in the lower esophagus from either ulcers or precancerous changes, it can lead to some issues with internal bleeding. And ultimately, again, the most feared complication of long-term damage from acid is esophageal cancer. And of course, people should be concerned if they develop any sorts of symptoms of unforeseen weight loss or, you know, things that might be attributable to having an early cancer. So there's quite a spectrum of symptoms that can develop. Most commonly, people experience heartburn, but it can really run the gamut depending on how long they've had the disease and how long they've really had damage to their esophagus.
So how do we know when it's time to call the doctor and get treatment? Can we use the degree to which we're taking over-the-counter medicines for heartburn as a clue?
Definitely. I think if you're experiencing regular heartburn symptoms, I would say if you're having heartburn on a daily basis or a few times a week, and it's not alleviated by some of these, you know, simple diet and lifestyle modifications, or if you're taking a lot of over-the-counter medications and finding that your symptoms are not, you know, adequately controlled, then I think it is worth consulting with your doctor to both discuss better ways of managing symptoms, but also whether you should see a specialist. And it's important because if your symptoms are such that there is, you know, an indication that you might be having damage from the acid in your lower esophagus, that can be detected early by a procedure known as an upper endoscopy that we as gastroenterologists can do, where we pass a very small flexible scope into the mouth, look into the esophagus, and see for ourselves, is there damage from the acid? Are there ulcers? And are there precancerous changes? And, you know, if we can find those sorts of pathologies early, then we can act upon it and be more aggressive to make sure that the damage from the acid doesn't progress into something more serious down the line.
Dr. Andrew Chan, Vice Chair of Gastroenterology at Massachusetts General Hospital, thank you very much for being with us and for sharing your study.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, testicular cancer is the most common cancer in American males ages 15 to 35. But the good news is it's highly treatable. We talk to a Mayo Clinic urologist for advice that every young man should hear next as MedClinic Radio continues.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Street. Mayo Clinic orthopedic surgeons like Dr. Sanj Kakkar are now using a new state-of-the-art camera system to perform hand and wrist surgeries.
The camera is about half the size of traditionally used technology. It's flexible, so it allows us to get into spaces that we've struggled in the past to see new things, to treat new conditions.
Dr. Kakkar says it can be used to treat wrist fractures, ligament injuries, arthritis, and more.
Really, the use is endless. And we're not talking about just arthroscopy. We're also talking about, for example, nerve decompressions at the elbow or at the wrist. It's basically allowing us to see things that we used to see with larger incisions through smaller incisions.
And smaller incisions may mean less pain and a quicker recovery for many patients.
We're at the cutting edge. We have the ability to really speak to our patients, inform them of what we're trying to do, and if we can get them back quicker and safer, then ultimately that's what we're trying to do.
For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to Med Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
According to the American Cancer Society, the rate of testicular cancer has been increasing in the U.S. and many countries for several decades, and the average age at the time of diagnosis is about 33. With important advice on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Compared with other types of cancer, testicular cancer is relatively rare. But testicular cancer is the most common type of cancer in males between the ages of 15 and 35, particularly in the United States. Testicular cancer is highly treatable, even when the cancer has spread beyond the testicle. Depending on the type and stage, there are several treatments or combinations of treatments available, and we're going to learn about those today. Here to discuss this with us is Dr. Matthew Ziegelman, urologist at the Mayo Clinic. Thanks for being here today, Dr. Ziegelman.
It's an absolute pleasure, and thanks for the invitation.
Would you tell us a little bit about how would someone know they might have testicular cancer? What are the symptoms?
Sometimes cancers, when they present with pretty obvious symptoms, but with testicular cancer, a lot of times it's just feeling a lump in the testicle. So most men who present with testicular cancer don't have pain, don't have discharge or systemic symptoms like fever or chills, but they have a change in how the testicle feels or the shape of the testicle or the look of the scrotum. And so oftentimes it's a young man or an older man who comes in and says, "Hey, doc, I feel something different."
Well, this is one of those types of cancer that seems to have be shrouded in a lot of mystery and have some myths that surround it. We hear about what might cause testicular cancer, and I'm hoping you can clarify for us. Some of the myths that I have read are, does riding your bike cause testicular cancer? Does injury to your testicle cause testicular cancer? Does having a vasectomy increase your risk?
I've heard all those myths. I've been asked all those questions in the context of caring for young men. The short answer is that, to our knowledge, none of those things, riding a bike, having a vasectomy, prior injury to the testicle, none of these things have been shown to increase your risk of testicular cancer. With respect to the bike riding, that may pertain to some of the prominent figures that have been diagnosed with testicular cancer in the past. I think with respect to testicular injury, if someone injures their groin, they're more likely to be kind of paying attention to the area, so they may notice something that's different, whereas they wouldn't have been paying attention earlier. And as far as a vasectomy, you know, there are at least 500,000 vasectomies performed in the United States each year, and there's far less diagnosis of testicular cancer, and there's no good evidence that that's associated with testicular cancer. I think the biggest risk factor here is, one, just being a man. We know that men who have a family history of testicular cancer, so maybe their dad or brothers have been diagnosed with that, that would be an increased risk, as well as having what's called an undescended testicle. So some men are born with a testicle that's not all the way down into the scrotum. It kind of sits up higher, and sometimes that requires surgery. And we know that that's also a risk factor for testicular cancer.
Why is it then that this is a cancer that strikes young men rather than the more elderly or older people?
In reality, testicular cancer can occur in men of all ages, really more prominent in young men because other cancers are less common, right? So the most common cancers in older men are things like prostate cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, whereas in young men, those cancers are far less common. And so for one thing, testicular cancer is just more prominent relative to these other diagnoses.
Are there other ways that men can prevent testicular cancer from developing?
To me, the most important thing is just as a young man, getting to know your anatomy. Oftentimes we'll talk about testicular self-exams, and to an extent, that's just every so often feeling the testicles, feeling the structures within the scrotum, and sort of understanding what your baseline is. So if something changes, you can then recognize it. I think also in general, the better your overall health, the less likely you are to develop cancer. So whether that's modifying your stress, getting good sleep, eating a heart-healthy diet, exercise, all of those things can really be beneficial for your overall well-being. And that's certainly true for all forms of cancer, including testicular cancer.
So a young man might find a lump, might be the way that this would be discovered in his testicle. And after getting up the courage to ask someone about it, what are the steps in a diagnosis?
Anytime a young man notices a new lump or a bump in the testicle, it can be very stress-provoking for that young man. But just important to know that there are a lot of other reasons that you can have a lump or a bump. So the first step is really to just get in to visit with a healthcare professional to have an examination. Oftentimes, if we feel something abnormal, we'll do what's called a testicular ultrasound. And that's a non-invasive test. There's no pain associated with that. It's just a way for us to actually image and take pictures to look and see, is that lump or bump something that's concerning for testicular cancer? We'll usually also get blood tests looking for what are called tumor markers. And these are basically compounds that we can measure in the blood that are sometimes associated with testicular cancer. Sometimes the tumors can secrete specific chemicals. And ultimately, if we're highly suspicious for a testicular cancer, and this is different than some other types of cancer, the way we diagnose this is actually to get a tissue diagnosis by removing the testicle via a surgery. It's an outpatient surgery. The recovery is pretty quick, and all guys do really well with that surgery, but really that is the way we make that final diagnosis.
What are the treatment options that are available, and how do you know which treatment to give a young man?
Testicular cancer in general, the treatment algorithm always starts again with that surgical removal of the testicle. For the vast majority of men, that's the treatment. Once you remove those cancer cells, remove the testicle, that oftentimes is all that that man will ever need for treatment of their testicular cancer. We do need to follow people closely because there is a chance that cells can spread outside the body. I call them rogue cells. For most men, that's the treatment. Now, if there's been testicular cancer that spread outside, oftentimes that will first go to lymph nodes that sit in the back of the abdomen, can spread to other places in the body. We diagnose that usually by CT scans and other types of imaging, and that may prompt us to consider other forms of treatment like chemotherapy or even radiation or surgery or some combination thereof. But even in that setting, I think really important to emphasize, and one thing I emphasize when I'm first visiting with a patient and saying I'm suspicious for testicular cancer, is that this is an extremely treatable form of cancer. The survival rates, even in the setting of men who've had testicle cancer spread outside of the testicle, are extremely high, far greater than 90%. And so I think really when people leave the office, I want them to have sort of that sense that we're going to tackle this together, and this is a bump in the road. The way we treat cancer, whether it's urologic cancers or elsewhere, there's been so many leaps and bounds over the last several decades, but specifically in testicular cancer, this is one of the most treatable forms of cancer.
Well, on the scale of things that might be anxiety provoking for a young man, I would think hearing that they must have a testicle removed would be really highly anxiety provoking. Does that render any difficulties with sexual function?
I think it's important to kind of differentiate the two aspects of what testicles do for us in the body. And they do really two things primarily. They make testosterone, which is sort of classically considered the male sex hormone, and they also produce sperm. And the nice thing is that for most men, we have a testicle on the other side that can, as I'll describe it, pick up the slack. So as far as, the ability of that testicle to produce enough testosterone to have normal range and to have normal sexual function, absolutely. The vast majority of men will maintain their sexual function. recovering from surgery and things like that, that can make people feel a little bit out of their element. But ultimately, long-term sexual function should be maintained for most men. Fertility as well. For the majority of men, they'll maintain fertility because the sperm production will be picked up by the other side. Now, once we start getting into those other types of treatments for more advanced testicular cancer with chemotherapy, radiation, other types of surgery, that's a little bit more nuanced. But for the majority of men, again, where we're curing their cancer by removing the testicle, we're maintaining fertility and sexual function. And another important thing as we're talking to these young men before surgery, we'll always, and I think everyone should be asking about this if this isn't brought up in the context of a visit, we'll always offer fertility preservation, where the young man will leave us some semen samples so that we can freeze that sperm, so that if fertility is affected down the road, we have the ability for that man and his partner to conceive.
Does a single testicle produce half of the sperm that two testicles did? Or when you say picking up the slack, do you have the same production later?
From the data that's available, it seems like if you look sort of at the numbers of sperm that are produced in a sample, that may go down slightly. It's not 50% though. So the other testicle has the ability to produce more than 50% of the normal sperm count. And when you look at, does that slight decrease in sperm count affect your ability to conceive? It doesn't look like it has a meaningful impact. So the ability to conceive spontaneously with your partner seems to be maintained, which is great news for our patients.
You mentioned earlier the advances that have been made in the last years and decades in this field. And I'm wondering, what is the research that's currently ongoing regarding testicular cancer? And what do you think is coming down the pike?
Yeah, there's always been a lot of cutting edge research looking at how we can better stage patients. So meaning how, when you come back for your follow-up after the testicles removed, what kind of scans are we doing? We're trying to minimize radiation exposure and things of that nature. But I really think the hottest topic these days pertains to, I think I briefly mentioned this, there's these chemicals that we measure in the blood called tumor markers that are secreted by certain types of tumors. And there's a lot of nuance there. And there's a lot of imperfection in some of these markers. But lately, there's been an interest in what's called microRNA, which is a really fine-tuned cellular marker that we can measure in the blood that seems to be a great resource for us to identify those patients who may have recurrence of their testicular cancer, but we're not seeing it on their images. And so this may actually be an opportunity for us to further enhance our follow-up for our young men in a safer and more efficacious manner. And ultimately, that may lend towards differences in how we offer chemotherapy and radiation therapy, surgery. We just finished a trial up here at Mayo Clinic for patients who had more advanced testicular cancer, where historically they'd be offered radiation or chemo. And instead, we're offered surgery, and we are one of the leading centers here, and the outcomes look very promising. The final results haven't been published yet, but the ability to avoid chemotherapy and radiation and undergo a surgical procedure where young men tend to recover quite well is a really nice option that could change the face of how we treat advanced testicular cancer. So lots of cutting-edge research being done throughout the United States, throughout the world, and even here at Mayo Clinic. It's really exciting.
Our thanks to Mayo Clinic urologist Dr. Matthew Ziegelman for being here today to talk to us about diagnosis and treatment for testicular cancer.
You can find Mayo Clinic Q&A wherever you get and subscribe to your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Up next, nearly half of adults in the United States suffer from high blood pressure. Exercise like walking is often recommended, but there's a surprising activity that's even more effective. We'll tell you about that and more on MedClinic Radio.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
What's the most effective physical activity for helping to bring down high blood pressure for people who have it or are at risk of developing high blood pressure? If you said brisk walking, you've hit on an important idea. But recent research suggests there's something even more effective than walking. Joining us now is Professor Phil Chilibeck from the University of Saskatchewan, who co-authored a study that's important not only for those with high blood pressure, but for all of us concerned about keeping our arteries healthy. So, Professor, spill the beans for us. What activity tested more effective than walking for reducing high blood pressure?
We found that doing a stretching program was more effective. What we think is happening here is that when you stretch a muscle, you're also stretching the blood vessels that are in the limb, and stretching the blood vessels chronically over time, so repeatedly over a few weeks, it probably reduces the stiffness of the blood vessels, and that's going to provide less resistance to blood flow and in turn reduce your blood pressure. I wanted to point out, though, that, you know, with the walking program, it was still effective in our study for reducing body fat around the waist area. So I would still recommend to people that they incorporate some kind of aerobic training into their overall program to reduce some of the other cardiovascular disease risk factors like body fat, high cholesterol, high sugar levels. Those would all be effectively reduced with walking. But in our particular study, when we focused on blood pressure, we just found that the stretching was more effective for reducing blood pressure.
And do I understand correctly that this would also reduce, you believe, the stiffness of the arteries?
Yeah, so we didn't measure arterial stiffness in our study, but past other research groups have measured arterial stiffness and found that it is reduced with a stretching program.
And Professor, we know that there have been other studies similar to this, but isn't this the first study to check the benefits of walking versus stretching directly?
Yeah, so this is the first study that assessed walking versus stretching directly in a group of people that have moderately high blood pressure.
We're visiting with Phil Chilibeck, professor of kinesiology from the University of Saskatchewan. He co-authored a study on physical activity to bring down high blood pressure. The Journal of Physical Activity and Health published the findings. So, Professor, let's drill down just a little bit. You studied 40 men and women with an average age of 60 over a period of 8 weeks, dividing them into two groups. Tell us what you asked each group to do.
The walking group did a brisk walking program, 30 minutes per day, 5 days per week for the 8 weeks. And then we gave the stretching group a series of, I believe it was 21 different stretches, just stretches of the major muscle groups in the body. And we had them do a, you know, a program that lasted about half an hour, 5 days a week for 8 weeks.
And how often did you check each participant's blood pressure and using what device?
We measured blood pressure before and after the 8 week programs. And we measured blood pressure in three ways. One is just the traditional way. We have someone in a chair and we measured their blood pressure while they were resting. And then we had them lie down and we measured blood pressure while they were laying down. That gives you just a more kind of a more precise measurement, I think, just because the person's in a more relaxed state. And then we also gave them these portable blood pressure monitors to wear for 24 hours. So they wore them during the day and during the night. And so the stretching program was effective for reducing blood pressure that we measured at nighttime, the blood pressure that we measured while sitting, and the blood pressure that we measured while laying down.
And by how much did the blood pressure decrease for those who stretched versus those who walked?
When you look at the changes across all those measurements, on average, the reduction was about 5 millimeters of mercury in the stretching versus the walking group. Healthy blood pressure is probably about 120 over 80. And then, you know, once you get higher than that, then you start to increase your risk. So our participants would have had, you know, a higher blood pressure. And so that reduction in blood pressure is a small to moderate reduction, but it's enough over the long term to clinically reduce your risk of heart disease.
You describe these as whole body stretches, but are there certain parts of the body where stretching can do more good than other parts for reducing high blood pressure?
Yeah, so when I said whole body, we had a variety of stretches for the upper body and the lower body. So each stretch only does one muscle group at a time. But I think if you just focused on, and again, this is just on previous research, but if you just focused on the large muscle groups of the lower legs, you can probably get a significant effect on your blood pressure. So I'm thinking about the quadriceps, the hamstrings, the calf muscles. So again, there's other studies from other labs that have shown that if you focus on stretching those muscle groups, it's effective for reducing your blood pressure.
Phil Chilibeck, professor of kinesiology at the University of Saskatchewan, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And that's MedClinic Radio for this week. MedClinic Radio is a production of Syndication Networks. If you would like to listen to past shows, check out our website, medclinicradio.com. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of MedClinic Radio.